This is Tamara Lexo, the Executive Director of Hopeful Hearts Ministry. We want to thank you for listening to Hopeful Hearts Podcast. If you have any questions or would like to find out how you can support or receive help from Hopeful Hearts Ministry, look for us at hopefulheartsministry.org.
Welcome to the Hopeful Hearts Podcast. This is Tamara Lexo, and I'm the Executive Director of Hopeful Hearts Ministry, and I'm here with my friend Shannon Carr, the founder of Hopeful Hearts Ministry. Hi, Shannon. How are you today?
Oh, it's been a little while.
It's been a couple weeks.
Yes, our last episode. So I'm very excited to have our guest on today.
Me too. And this is, we've said this year we wanted to put some focus on having other guests on and hearing some stories of survival and how survivors have turned their place of surviving into thriving. And so we have some guests today who are really thriving and doing that in a really big way. And we have heard their story, and you have talked to one of our guests today, and they're like kind of a big deal. Like they've been on Huffington Post. We saw were interviewed by Huffington Post, and they're talking about something that's really serious today. So I do want to put a disclaimer. Not that what we ever talk about on here is not serious, because it is, but today especially want to say that today's topic, you probably don't want to have children in the room, and it's very sensitive. So just use your own discretion before listening today, as to what you might be able to handle. So we have we're going to be talking about the Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate and an abusive situation there. So I want to welcome our guests, Patricia Budd and Michael Kovacs. So thank you both for being here today. Welcome to the Hopeful Hearts Podcast.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so Shannon, you know Patricia from before, so I'll let you start things off.
Absolutely. And in all honesty, I don't know if we've seen each other face to face. We never did.
No, we have.
we back in the day, so back when I started Hopeful Hearts in 2012, it was around that time that you and I started talking, and we didn't do Zoom. I didn't do FaceTime. I didn't do any of that. So it's really good to just see your beautiful face in front of me.
Well, thank you. And likewise, to see yours.
Thank you so much. So this topic for me, it's really, really hard. Everybody knows that I'm Catholic and but I also have, my thoughts and feelings about many aspects of the humanness of the church, right? Mm-hmm. And through Hopeful Hearts, I've helped many different people, not just Catholics, but other, faith-based denominations that have been harmed by somebody within their, mm-hmm. Parish or their, congregation or, mm-hmm. Whatever the case may be. And it's difficult. It's like the worst, in my opinion, if you were to say that there's a worst type of abuse, which I don't really think that we can. But in my opinion, when you marry spirituality within that abuse, like it's like, to me, it's the worst, because that is what we're supposed to have, is the love of God. Right. And that is so important. So, when Patricia, Therese, is that how you would say it? Like, I remember
that was my cover name.
Yeah. That's how I knew her to begin. I was it just, it killed me. It killed me. And it's one of the main reasons why I even started Hopeful Hearts. I just wanted people to have a voice. And all of the scandal was breaking out in the Catholic Church around this. That's what actually led me to start this ministry. Because it's not a Catholic ministry. We're faith-based. We help all people, even non-believers. Like, we're going to help anybody. And, but it is what led me to start it, just because I was so just floored personally that people of God could do, you know, such, you know, horrible things. And so with all that being said, I'm just, it's been such a wonderful, beautiful experience for me and gift to see what Patricia has done in her life and, over this last decade. And how she has, you know, learned to thrive and not just survive. And so if you don't mind I'm going to start with you. If you can share as much as you want about your story so people can understand what we're talking about. And, you know, all I ask is maybe not too intense details, because that will re-trigger or harm people. So I
can understand that. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So, just the basics. So, I already came from a background of abuse in the home. So, and that was physical, sexual abuse, and just going to leave it as that. And then when I went into the order, thinking that I would be dealing with something like that. So I went into the order in 1995, I became postulant of Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate. And then from there stemmed the beginnings of abuse, you know, physical, spiritual, emotional, verbal. I didn't really get the brunt of everything until I was overseas. And then I became a novice. And then in 1996, July 16th, 1996, I was sent to Italy. And so I was missionary. I was actually sent against my will to go to Italy. I mean, at that time, I really didn't want to go. I was just too not ready, and they wouldn't give me Dramamine for medicine to go on the plane. So I really had a horrible plane ride. My very first plane ride was horrible, and it was, you know, against my will. So I like to bring up the fact is not only that there was abuse, there was also human trafficking too, as well as labor trafficking. And so I didn't realize it until after I saw The Sound of Freedom. And then I started researching, well, what is human trafficking? You know, because I really, you know, did not know. So in the Order of the Sisters Minor of Mary Immaculate, yeah, I was being abused, but I witnessed so much abuse, different types of abuse to other sisters, which was physical.
Who was abusing you, just to clarify? Well,
starting in postulancy, it was Sister Teresa Kovacs. And then it carried on when I was first professed. I mean, there were sisters that did little things that you kind of knew that it was off, but you couldn't really say it was abuse because it was like a one-time event and that was it. But Sister Stella Marie, I was with her as a junior professed. And so you make your vows for 3 years, poverty, chastity, obedience, and total consecration to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, that you're totally given to her. So whatever your superior said, you did. Okay. And so, but this superior was physically abusive. I mean, she actually, you know, she would, you know, beat up on me. She locked me in the apartment. They didn't take away the phone though. So I called home, you know, but it was like, surviving something like that, it was hard than when I was a child, because they represented God to you. Mm-hmm. When somebody represents God to you and they abuse you, you think God's doing that. And then you wonder, well, there's something terribly wrong with me. So
let me pause right there, just because I know we're going to have people listening, like I said, that aren't Catholic. So maybe they don't even understand, you know, what is it? Was it a convent? I know that there's a difference between like nuns and sisters. And then you said that, you know, whatever your superior says to do, you have to do it. So can you maybe give just as if I am not Catholic at all and know nothing about this.
Sorry
like
about that.
What's that break? Well, it's okay, but just trying to think of our listeners. Yeah.
So we're an active order, and we follow after the charism of St. Maximilian Kolbe, and so therefore we follow under the vows of poverty, chastity, obedience. Poverty, you don't own anything. Chastity, you keep chaste. And then obedience, you are obedient to the church, to the Catholic Church, to the Pope and on down, and then to your superior especially. So whatever your superior says is like the voice of God. That's how they portrayed it to us. They did not tell us apart from sin, you know, or something that goes against your conscience. So like, say your superior says, go and steal this, you know, or go and just get this. It's not stealing, but you know it's wrong. You don't have to obey. It's not a mortal sin. But if your superior says, I want you to go upstairs and make up all the beds, and you don't, that's actually a mortal sin, because that's against obedience. So that's how, as we were in formation, thought that, you know, we had to obey down to the very finest detail, you know. And it, sometimes it just drove you crazy, because you knew in your head that there'd be a better way. You knew in your head that something's not right, but you couldn't say anything. And there'd be consequences if you did not obey.
Okay.
Now, forgive me, because I am not Catholic, and I so when you say you're superior, that's like the nun, that's the sister that's over you there?
yes okay. She's in charge of you. Yes.
And is there just one that's in charge of you, or is there like a hierarchy?
There is, but sometimes there's an assistant superior that just kind of just carries out some of the duties when the main superior is gone. And so it's kind of like, I don't know, like there's a hierarchy. There's the mother general, there's the mother vicar, and they are like in Rome. And then you have Sister Teresa Kovacs, who's the U.S. delegate. And then you have your guardian. Your guardian is the one who lives with you. She is your local superior.
Gotcha.
Okay. I didn't know if that helped a little bit.
No, that does help. Well, with that being said, we'll come back to you and learn.
Okay.
But I think maybe this is a good time for Michael to speak up, because Sister Teresa Kovacs, right? Michael is your sister?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So,
you know, I felt like we had a Dateline moment there when Patricia said Sister Kovacs, and it's like Michael's name is on the screen, and it's like, da da da.
Sorry.
Big reveal.
We have a lot of Sister Teresa's, so I have to say her last name, because I don't want to incriminate somebody else.
Mm-hmm. Right. No, that's it. That makes sense.
Sorry, Michael.
No.
All right. No, apologize for that. It's fine by me. I mean.
Yeah.
So, Michael, was she your older sister?
She is my oldest sister. I'm the youngest. There were three of us. She's 10 years older than me.
Okay.
So there's a lot of distance and age in that one.
Gotcha. So do you want to maybe explain a little bit of like what you know in regards to Sister Teresa Kovacs, of going in? Did she start this order in the United States, or like what, how did that happen? And then
Patricia, you're going to be backing me up in a minute, because she knows the facts better than the dates better than I do. But the order of the SMMI was started by Patrizzi in the early 80s, right?
Correct. Yes.
Okay. All right. Back to me. So it started by Patrizzi, but she didn't have a toehold in the US until she found my sister. Okay. So she found my sister, and that's when the ball started rolling. So Patrizzi was kind of in Italy in that area, but needed something in the US to really start growing. And that's where my sister came in I guess her late 20s. Yeah.
So your sister was already kind of on that path of becoming a nun, and then she was found.
Yeah.
I mean, what our listeners are thinking probably. So
I know. Well, the thing is, I've I want to state one thing right up out of the gate. I have no problem with religion, organized religion, blah, blah, blah. Nuns. It's like, you know, I mean, I don't, I don't go into McDonald's and yell at the fry guy, you know, I don't blame Ronald McDonald. I mean, you know, but I'm just saying just out of the gate, it's not a blanket. Right. All that happened was specific. But anyway, so but she's looking for something. She's kind of a lost soul in a way, single. And she's just kind of like looking around. She was vulnerable and like kind of looking in that angle to kind of go into religious. And then unfortunately she stepped in the bear trap and Patrizzi found her. And that was the end. That was it. Uh-huh. That was really the end. And like that was, when that happened, like light switch. Boom.
So because, you know, obviously she is the one that kind of started the abuse and maybe even groomed the others to do a lot of the emotional abuse. I mean, am I right, Patricia? Like, that's kind of what.
Okay, happened, so right? Michael's telling you how Teresa Kovacs entered the order. Mm-hmm. Okay, so the formation is, and you'll find this in like some of the older orders before Vatican II came out, is that basically there's a very intense formation. And then through Passionly and Novitiate is like the hardest part of it. And so Patrizzi was trained in Teresa Kovacs. She may already had it in her before she entered into the Institute, but into the order, but they trained that Patrizzi trained her to be that type of superior who would be abusive. They tried to train me when I was in the order. I flat out refused because I knew it wasn't right. You know, I got counseling in the United States. I worked as a CNA. I had classes behind me telling me that that wasn't right. So I would get punished for not being abusive.
Okay, you're saying that Patrizzi? Is that
Mother Maria Elisabetta Patrizzi? I'm saying that as you.
Patrizzi's school. Teaching people to be abusive?
Yes. Basically?
Yeah.
Yes. Yep.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Perfect. It's got to come from somewhere. I mean, that's the whole pipeline that the idea is she had to be trained. I mean, how do I put this gently? Teresa was, I guess, fragile before she went in. I'll put it in those terms.
Okay.
But so, which we'll probably get to later, but the idea is she got trained in the dark arts by Patrizzi. As I've said before, it's like she was little before she went in, and then somehow she got pumped full of this, you know, evil toxic waste, and then went into a whole other league of play. So, I mean, that's the thing, is like, it's just like, but in my view, regardless of what happened, regardless of how she turned out the way she did, it's like, she's doing it out of, you know what I mean? Like, I can't let that get off the hook. I mean, then the stuff that
she's done, to do it. Yeah.
Say what?
She still chose that path.
She still chose. And there was so many times, you know, I mean, she could have left any time. It was like she was away from home. She was right in Jersey. I mean, she was to visit the house every weekend. I mean, it wasn't like there's a whole, she was over in, you know, Tanzania and needed a flight back. She was in Jersey, so she could have more complicated than that. I don't want to be that dismissive,
right?
In general, it's like, you know, there was that issue, but you know, that's
no. I mean, I think that all of this is so important in any story. I was abused. My first abuser was my grandfather. Michael, I don't know if you know anything about my story, but. I was incest through my grandfather, but I know more about his past and then the abuse that he went through. And, you know, it doesn't make it like it's better. It just, it brings about a kind of an under, like, if you will, maybe an understanding, or many people want to know, like, why do people do, we'll never have those right answers.
Well, that's why we say hurt people.
Yeah.
And it sounds dismissive, but it's true. You learn to hurt from the person that hurts you. And there's a cycle there. And until someone decides to break the cycle, it will continue.
Mm-hmm. But I think people want, though, people want the narrative line, the arc of the narrative, meaning mm-hmm. why did they do it? Right? So you get, right. and then you, it's the same reason, I just made a bit gross, but like this same idea with cancer, like as you know, someone mm-hmm. gets cancer, oh, well, they smoked. Like, well, does right. that really help anything? You're still, yeah. or yeah. they drank, right? It's like that doesn't, mm-hmm. you like the narrative linkage, like, well, they yes. did X, so Y happened, mm-hmm. but still dealing with the moment of the problem.
Right.
Right. It just helps our brains process mm-hmm.
things. We are a people that like to make sense of things. We want to figure it out, and we want to put the pieces together, and we also want to point a finger.
Mm-hmm. You know? Of course.
So.
So real quick question before we kind of go back into then mm-hmm. Patricia's story, Michael. When you said she was like 10 years older than you, when you were growing up, was she particularly mean or anything like that? Or
yeah, I mean, she had a mean streak. I'll put it that way, because I really, it's for me, it's a little bit on the vagueish side, because you know, by mm-hmm. the time I was six, she was 16. By the time I'm 10, right. she's in college. Mm-hmm. I'm 18, she's, you know, already, so she had a nasty streak about her, sure. And that sure. was a problem. That was a problem. Mm-hmm. But you didn't think like, okay, so what? I mean, like you're, right. it's your family. What do you know? You know, it's weird. You know, it's different, but you're right. like, oh, whatever. I mean, you deal with it. That being said, I mean, that's why when she made this leap over to the very, very dark side, it was like, it was a progression that didn't shock me. It was kind of like, there was so much gear slippage early on, like before she joined in. Mm. When she made this leap, it wasn't like a total, it was horrible. It was disgusting. But it was like, yeah, I could see that happening. You know, yeah. What I mean? What Patrizzi did to her, what all happened out in Italy, I don't know. But I think that was the thing, was like, yeah, we could all say like, yeah, that's about right.
Right.
You know what I mean? It was a logical step. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Okay. Well, that's helpful. All right. So, uh-huh. Patricia, like, so you feel called, you like their charism, you know, of Maximilian Kolbe. I guess y'all did a lot with prisons. I know those that aren't Catholic probably don't know a lot about the saints, but that was kind of what Maximilian Kolbe is known for, is helping or just being a saint for those that are in prison and that kind of thing. But you can.
Their addictions as well.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And actually, I found out about St. Maximilian Kolbe because I went to St. Hyacinth's Seminary in Granby, Massachusetts. And I was already on that path of searching for a religious order. And so they had a blue flyer there, and they were actually stationed there for a while. They were there for a while, and then they left. But it was like Eucharistic centered, Marian, Terezina, meaning like after the little flower, and Kolbe. And I was just like, I already just joined the MI, the Militia Immaculata, which is found by St. Maximilian Kolbe. I joined it. And so now I'm looking for an order to carry on the charism. I wanted to give my life to God, you know, because I didn't think I could do it in any other way, you know, and I just felt a strong calling. When I was 8 years old, I didn't even know about being Catholic. I wasn't Catholic until I was 13, but I was having a dream that I was with a white veil and I was kneeling, praying for the dying. You know, they're on the bed dying. And actually, that happened. I was a novice in Casa Benedetta in Italy, and I was praying for the dying. So it was like a deja vu of my dream, you know? And it's like, I really do feel I had the authentic vocation, you know, to become a sister. Mm-hmm. And I do believe many others did as well. Going back to what you're saying, this is about formation, is also about, you know, as you know, in cults and in abuse, it's about control. How do you control the individual? Yeah. So, you know, and we were taught how to, like, have self-control of ourselves, how to die of the world and all that. And that's all good. But when it comes to a certain point where your human qualities are going, like your basic rights are not being met, you know, that becomes an issue. And the saddest thing about it is that it was a great order as far as trying to help others, but it was a lie because while we were on the outside, we look fine, you know, and we always had to smile. You always had to smile no matter what you were going through. You had to smile. And if you didn't, you get in trouble. And that's the presentation they wanted. You know, we were little Marys running around because we had the blue habit, you know, the blue veil, you know, and we were able to break through a lot of barriers because of our habit alone. So Patrizia used that as a form of control and power. Mm-hmm. And I think with Teresa Kovacs, she got the power by having control and power in the United States, mm-hmm. you know. And I think that's what creates a monster. You know, if you already have something going on and you're not working on yourself and or you're just your life is so bad that you got to take it out on another person. She had leeway to take it out on whoever she was formating. Mm-hmm. You know? And that's a scary thing that during that time there was no screenings. There was no psychological profile before you entered. Yeah. I was just asked a couple of questions. Boom. I was allowed to join the order. That was it. Wow. I said, and nowadays you cannot do that, you know? And that's what happened. So just to give you kind of like a heads up on that.
Right.
Wow.
I mean, anybody though, even if to this day, I mean, unfortunately, there might still be a situation like this, not even just in, you know, this spiritual aspect. I just watched that documentary on Netflix where they have those schools where they're, you know, it's for teens that are supposedly bad.
Oh my gosh, I watched that too.
I've seen two documentaries, yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a very similar type aspect, I guess, except y'all are out to do good. But yet their, you know, sister, you know, or Teresa Kovacs was wanting control over you. And so she was taking away any semblance of your personality or your voice or your, you know, but thank God that God protected your ability to know what right from wrong. I mean, earlier You were saying that they were trying to teach you how to be abusive to those even coming in, but your heart was saying no, I don't want to do this. This is not right. And you held on to that. And I think that's beautiful. I think, and you know, that's how God can make good from all situations, right? Is if we allow him to, he will protect those aspects of us. In my opinion, that's my opinion.
Yeah.
God was watching over me a lot because I was in a lot of really scary situations in the order. One, carrying money across, you know, from one country to another, and I could have got, you know, in jail for 18 years. That alone was scary. But I mean, also just being physically abused in a foreign country, like try have that happen and you have no one to talk to, no one to reach out to, you know. My survival, it was more about survival than thriving order. It was like, and sometimes, you know, there would be sisters that would spy on you too. So you didn't know who you could trust. And actually, I had sisters come to me and tell me what had happened to them while I was still in the order. And I was just that I called home. But then I was just like, no, I really still want to be a sister. This is just like one person, you know, one bad apple, you know, it's not the whole order. I didn't know the seriousness, the severity of the abuse, like was so intense until like the last 2 years I was in the order. And then I'm like, no, I gotta leave. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not of God at all. You know, maybe.
Did your family know this was going on at the time?
Okay, so my family, see, my family didn't want me to join the order in the first place because they thought it was wasting my life. Okay. And then I went overseas, and then I went to Turkey, the Middle East, and they were really scared because it was at the point before the 9/11 type of thing. Mm-hmm. So they were really, really scared. But my family, I had to hide everything from my family except for when I wanted to start leaving. And then my sister, my twin sister and I, we had this code because mm-hmm. the sister would listen to your conversation on the phone. So you had to something like a certain code that they wouldn't understand. And that meant like, okay, I'm leaving, you know, I want to escape, you know, or something's going on. So, and then we were, always under the disguise. My grandmother was very ill, you know, she may be dying. It's true. She was at that point. So it wasn't like I was lying, but it was just added in that little tidbit too, because after 9/11, I really kind of started feeling like, you know, this is not a family. This is, you know, I don't know what this is, you know, but I need to leave. And I wish I really could have taken every sister with me, because really I felt bad leaving behind, you know. I feel like sometimes I have survivor's guilt, you know, because it's like I left in 2003 and there's some that stayed to the very end, and it's like so much abuse had happened. But it was just a grace of Almighty God, because it's like, I was just given a lot of graces when I was young, but also the counseling that I received, and I decided I wanted to take care of other people. I wanted to help the wounded, to help the dying. I wanted to help the sick. So it kind of made me look at everything like I'm looking at Jesus crucified. Would I do this to Jesus crucified? That's what put my sense of, I guess, moral ethics in that category. Like, okay, so I'm not going to yell at a child. I'm not going to force a postulant to go upstairs and take care of the sick and dying when she can't do it. She's freaking out. So I'm working these extra shifts. Of course, I got yelled at. I got in trouble for not doing what they wanted, because it's against obedience. So it's like, I committed a mortal sin. So that's the type of life that you lived with day in and day out when you're in order. Like your soul's going to hell. They practice, Mother Elizabeth de Patrizi was a Carmelite nun. Then she became a hermit, and then she worked for the Shroud of Turin. She was all over the place. But the thing is, she brought the Jansenism, which is a heresy in the Catholic Church. And basically Jansenism is that only a few are selected to go to heaven. Only a few will go. So everybody else, like, you're no good no matter what you do. You're like, if you're not destined to go, you're not going to go. So it's like every time, like, say you open up the drawer wrong or something, oh, your school's going to go to hell. You're selfish, you know, like,
oh my goodness.
So you're beaten upon spiritually, not only physically, but spiritually, you know. And then you had these penances you had to do because, like, you were bad. You were a terrible sister. And it's just like, oh my gosh, what did I do? You know, it's like literally end of my stay as a sister, I started having psychosis in the chapel. I was seeing things that are holy as demonic because of just the switch around, you know. It just was, you know.
I mean, emotional abuse is the worst. I know that there was plenty of physical and some of your you know things. And Michael, I'm gonna let you speak. I know you're like, I need to say something.
Oh no,
but you know, I will say, if people are wanting to hear more of the actual details, there is another podcast out there. And maybe Patricia or Michael, you could tell me who the name of the actual podcast, but this one in particular was called The Cult of Simi, right?
S-M-M-I. The Cult of, yes. It's an,
Speak about
it's
that.
It's a podcast that my friend Scott does. Mm-hmm. And he doesn't normally do anything remotely like this, but I told him the story and he was like, hey, can I interview you? And I said, sure. And we went, he's a musician too. We went to school together in Minneapolis. Mm-hmm. So he heard the story and he was like, and I just talked. I mean, I've known him for 20, 6 years. So we, you know, I just, you know, I just talked to him. It was like talking to a friend. And so I, then he put that up. And then when he put that up, then Patricia came on board, and then Antoinette was the second, and Patricia, and then Georgiana. So a lot, they came forward. So what I wanted to say really importantly is for anybody listening, everybody, please understand the following. This was all legit and above board when you looked at it and how it was presented. This whole SMMI, Sisters Mater Mary Immaculate, was on paper and to the outside world, run exactly the way every other nun thing is. That's the point. People think, how did this happen? How could it be? Like, why didn't it look like up front? It was not like, you know, people wearing tracksuits and waiting for, you know, a spaceship to land. This was actually, you know, it was approved by Rome. It was approved by bishops. So it was above board. So it was a strange con game where after you went in, after you went in and said, yep, and then the door shut and then you were screwed. Because people tend to get this strange thing of like, well, why did BA go in, or why did they, like, it was legit.
Yeah,
it was all on board, and but that's the point. Keep that in mind. That's the weird part. One of the weird parts about this, but it's all above
which board. Is how a lot of abusers are. They put on the smile and the charm, and you know they lure you in and make you think that what they have is safe and inviting, and they tend to prey on people who are vulnerable. It's like they have a sixth sense about them where they can draw in the most vulnerable people. They sense the people that will be easy for them to prey on, and they do. It's like a Jekyll and Hyde thing, you know. So I can see where that would be a thing where it would be above board and all the paperwork would be right, and it would look like a very legit order to the authorities. And then they'd lock people in.
Right. And I'm sure that aspects of it, obviously, it's what led Patricia to want to come in. I mean, aspects of it were good and legit. But what happens is for anything in regards, even for this, even for Hopeful Hearts Ministry, if there's ever a point, Tamara, that you and I start saying, oh, you know, well, it's us and it's about me, and there's no act of humility or no act of understanding, in my opinion, that this is God's ministry, then that is where the enemy gets in there, and you can start doing things that are more, you know, to lift you up or to, you know, whatever. And it could be the littlest, it doesn't have to be abuse, but that to me is what sounds like happened here, is that lack of humility, and suddenly that kind of grandiose God ego came forward and was like, I need control, and this is the best way to control. So Michael, I want to go to you. At what point, because I believe that whenever you started kind of coming forward and recognizing things, Patricia was already out, right? Patricia, you had already left.
I already left.
Yeah. By the time, okay, if you, the full story of this is I ask everybody to bring a lunch, a dinner, and a snack. It's going to be a long one, but I'll make it brief. And that we're just getting to chapter one.
Well, that's but why I'm offering the other podcast. People can go from here to that, listen to all the
details. More details, go to strangepathways.smmi. Now, just a long story short, I basically made it a point from the beginning to not get involved. I was 18, 19 years old. I'm a musician. I want nothing. I'm like, do you. I'm out. And I didn't really think too terribly much. I just kind of pushed it to the side. And then in 2011, my mom had a stroke. And that's when I realized things got weird. And even then, as I was trying to find out what was going on in the order, I was getting blocked and rejected. So that's when I began to look. Okay. And it was a problem because there was nothing on them. There was nothing online. I knew some of the nuns in the SMMI, because the order had split, like in what, 2010 or something, it split. So there was the old crew without Patrizzi and the new crew. So I was friends with the old crew. They weren't talking. So when it was just, it was horrible. You couldn't find anything out. And then finally, through online, through FatMass, this PHATMASS, I signed up there under a pseudonym and wound up getting to posting questions and stuff. And then through a turn of events, I wound up getting a Vatican document stating that Patrizzi was pretty much being reprimanded by the Vatican for abuse. And when I got that letter, then, well, all bets were off. Then it was like the doors opened, because I was seeing stuff done to my mother and in the family by my sister. And I'd see this stuff, but there was no, I had no backup. Like, who are you going to be? Are you going to believe the weird guy with the guitar and the hat? Or are you going to believe a nun? I mean, there's no contest here. It's kind of like, what are you going to, of course, believe the nun. Don't be, he's, you know, I'm just saying that was a big problem of being believed. But once I had the document stating that Patrizzi was reprimanded by the Vatican, and I was like, I was off to the races. Then I posted a link on I posted something on FatMass saying, hey, look, when anybody wants to know, you contact me. And then that's how Patricia got in contact with me and then all the others, you know. So that was it. And it kind of snowballed from there. But it was insanely locked down. I cannot stress how locked down this place was. And no one wanted to say anything. That was the other thing. There was also people were really trying to shut the conversation down on FatMass. And thankfully it got through. And then that's why I wanted meeting these women. But even after, in before I had the letter, I remember going to confession in New York City, and I told the priest, because it's bonkers. The abuse was crazy because it was affecting my mom's health and everything else, and it was all crazy. And then I went to confession in Manhattan, and I told the priest about this, and he told me, I think you're lying just to mess with me. And I was like, it's a true story. And my first thought was, ouch. My second thought, I swear you, was like, I broke the priest. I mean, this is New York City. This is Sodom and Gomorrah subway. This is the second point, baby. This is it. And I broke the priest. I was like, yes.
Word.
That's true. So I was like, I'm screwed. No one's going to believe me. Because what, it's so out of the realm of you've ever heard. So when I finally got the letter, that's when I put the word out and got a crew. And I got all these people. And that was the beginning of it was painful, because someone I know who was in there was sexually abused by my sister, told me that, and then your life's never the same. But to be believed, like that's what I don't know if I'm jumping ahead or behind, but I was hoping that when all these women who were survivors would talk and meet, it would be like, oh yeah, this happened, and that's why. All the women, this
is validated.
And all the women whom I spoke to, they had not spoken to each other in years. They knew of each other, but no one knew where anybody was. But every single solitary story was exactly the same. Everything. So I was like, okay, we're on to something, because the narrative is the same, but they don't talk to each other anymore. So when that happened, I went, oh, we got some problems. So that's when I began to try to get the word out through media. And then I tried one media, I'll just say it, NPR. I pitched it to them, and they had like 60 emails or more between them, and then they dropped it, and then I gave up, and then Huffington Post found me. Literally out of nowhere.
Wow.
And then that's how the word got out. And word has to, because there's over, Patricia, what are we, like 250, 350 people? How many we got here?
Yeah.
We think this pipeline.
Yeah. Also, you got to think about the brothers, too.
Yeah.
The brother brings as well, in two branches of the brother branch,
there were male versions of nuns called brothers, and they were female, right. So it was crazy. So we're just trying to get the word out so that the survivors know, and survivors' parents,
Right.
Ida Sepulveda's mom called me up and she did not know. This woman called me out of nowhere. I'm driving on the turnpike. I'm like, hello. And she did not know what happened to her daughter when her daughter was in the SMMI, and then her daughter left and wouldn't talk to her again. And it's a longer story, but the mom didn't know. Now the mom knows, right? Uh-huh. And now people know. I mean, and people need to know because, look, we know I know what I saw, and all the survivors know what they saw, but they were in 6 countries.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
they had a good footprint, and so you know who knows what happened.
So
wow,
yeah,
this is so fascinating, and I feel like we could have 3 or 4 episodes on this. Oh. But it is for anybody that is interested to hear like the actual more detailed stories of the other. Again, that other podcast is Strange Pathways, and just type in SMMI, right?
Also, yes. And also you can go to the Huffington Post story by Jessica. The Huffington Post was what really helped. It was Jessica Blank was the reporter. She's great. She's great.
Huffington Post, Jessica Blank.
Or just Huffington Post, SMMI, COVAX. You'll find it. AOVACS. Yeah.
An article on convent reform by Miss O'Day. Mm-hmm. And that was actually through a fellow person from a Regretti network who was also in an abusive order. And so she's I guess she does writing for them. And so she did one on convent reform. And also I actually did something with NPR with SNAP a little mm-hmm. bit. It doesn't go into great detail, but it kind of like gives like the fundamental.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And well, if Netflix is interested, please give us a call.
Right. Well, I mean,
they should be
watching that other documentary. I thought, well, I mean, this probably could be a really good one too. I mean, they're almost very similar, just different types of, you know, organizations or institutions, I should say. But
so what has happened to? I was going to say, how did this end? Like where?
It hasn't. It really didn't end. You know, the SMMI, the SMMI started, and then in like 2009 or 10, they split, one without Patrizzi and then one sort of with. Patrizzi tried to do another order, and that order wouldn't. That's how she got busted because of this one. So they never formed anything. The SMMI, by the end, had one member with that name left. One member. Oh. And that was it. And then, you know, there's more details than that, but that kind of dissolved. But unfortunately, my sister Teresa still dresses like a nun and is still, you know, living like a nun and or living... looking like a nun and whatever. So it hasn't really stopped. Say what?
Is she with an order at all? Or
you want to pick that one up, darling? You want to pick that up? You go.
Okay. So she has collected individuals like either to help pay for rent in her mother's house that she inherited after Teresa, you know, after Michael, your mother passed away, of course, you know that. And, but there was also a new girl she entered or their group. I have contacted Metuchen Diocese, like, I don't know how many times. They seem to like not communicate with me. They just don't care about the situation. They're saying that even though she dresses like a nun, anybody can wear whatever clothes they want to, but she's no longer in ministry. She did have a job working with kids. She was a DRE until Michael and I got wind of it. And then Georgiana and 2 other people went to the diocese and said, hey, she's a fake sister and she has a history of sexual abuse. So we're fighting this constantly and she hops from church to church. So this is what Michael and I are saying. The abuse has never stopped. There's still like the danger that she could harm somebody.
That is so scary to me. It's scary that You can't just wear any uniform you want. You can't sit there and put on a policeman's uniform and act like you're a policeman, or you can't put on a priest.
Happening.
Or so you think.
My mouth is just like.
Oh no, here's the thing. I'll tell you that I'll answer the question that's spinning in your heads. I can see it. Back in 2011, when all this started, I contacted the Diocese of Metuchen, right? And they told me pretty much this. I have it in an email too, but on the phone. Basically, it was like, well, do you have a police report on it? No. Okay, whatever. And they didn't care because it was in terms of the abuse. I'll tell you exactly why they didn't care, because it was woman on woman, right? And they don't care because there's no lawsuits that they have a precedent with. If it was male on male or male on female, they have precedents for that, right? You know, they know they can get busted. They have, you know what I mean? But female on female, they don't care. No one's, they have no track record of that. So they don't care. They wouldn't even let me come in. And they let her dress like a nun. Okay. So they let her dress like a nun because I don't know why, but I think that's probably why, because they're like, they know the Huffington Post story is out there. They spoke to Patricia. They spoke to me. They know what this woman is about.
They know it.
They just wash their hands. I'm like, okay, guys, good luck.
Oh, my word.
This is exactly one reason why I started Hopeful Hearts and went the path that I did, is to allow that aspect of having your voice, right? And the only way that we're going to be able to eradicate, I wish we could eradicate abuse altogether. Unfortunately, I don't know if any of us will live to that day, but the only thing we can do is be loud and proud and louder, you know, like just constantly say as much as we can. And as shocking and horrible and all the things that I'm hearing right now, and I just want to weep inside, but then go, it makes you feel like your hands are tied behind your back, and that's frustrating. And I can't stand that, you know, but keep talking. Like, if y'all have a podcast and you're listening to this, then have these two on, you know,
right. It's our job to be the voice for the people who are not using their voice or can't use their voice.
Yeah.
So,
that's a good segue to kind of get towards where we always do try to, you know, focus on, and that is not just surviving but thriving. Mm-hmm. And a big aspect of that is having your voice and feeling, you know, really doing something. And I commend, I commend you, Michael. Thank you. You didn't have to. And I really want people to hear this. Like, this was his sister. Now, granted, she was messing with your mom or hurting your mom or whatever aspect of that. And so you had care and concern for your mom, but you had care and concern for these other people, these other women. You didn't have to. You didn't have to move forward and try to find all the things. Or even once you found what you needed for your own family, you could have stopped there. You didn't have to keep going. And I commend you for that, because that's how we can start to eradicate things. If people start looking outside of themselves and have a love for others, God's love for others, enough to just go, this is not right. Like, I need to say something, do something, acknowledge it out loud and say, hey, that is not right. So I want to call that out for anybody listening, because I think a lot of people, it's almost, unfortunately, a nature for people to go, I don't want to get
right.
involved.
We go, well, that's not my place to get involved, or we're, oh, that's too big. I can't make a difference, or, we shouldn't talk about that. But you didn't do any of those things, Michael.
I think the idea being, thank you both. I think the point for me was, the worst part was living in with no one believing you. I think that's that was the absolute hell point, was when you're in the, that's the other reason why I do any interview I'll take, is the worst part was when I was in the middle of all this before Patricia, before anything, like the first year or two or three in. And nobody was giving me help, not the diocese, the whole thing. Right. So I was like, that was the worst, when you feel like you're absolutely alone in what you went through. So the nanosecond that I got that letter and it cracked open, I was running. Silence is way worse, and making excuses is way worse. I'm like, it'll set you free. I mean, it's the only thing I can tell you is if you hiding it, lying about it, ignoring it, makes a prison for yourself. Get out there, just say it, boom.
Bring it out of the darkness into the light.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we say all the time, shame exists in the darkness. It cannot exist in the light.
Yeah. So, Patricia, I know that, you know, just speak a little bit, and I know we're almost out of time here, and we might have y'all on again. But I would just speak a little bit to, I know your journey, it's been difficult. You had gotten married and all of that. You don't know, have to go into detail and all of that, but you know, what helped you to kind of get you even to where you are today and strong enough? You know, I know Tamara and I don't know if y'all listen to any of our other podcasts, but you know, we're both
Survivors
of multiple abuses. Still suffer through different PTSD moments or triggering. It's just a part of what our journey is. So we're not, none of us are like, I'm 100% better and everything's going to be fine. We've gotten into other abusive situations. You know, we've done that whole, that's a typical path of someone surviving and then learning how to thrive. But for you, what do you feel has been like, I guess, the most, you know, encouraging as you have kept going?
Well, God has. one word, God. I just wanted to go back. If it wasn't for Michael Kovacs, because I did tell my bishop in 2003, it was Bishop Dupre, but he was accused of sexual abuse in 2 altar servers. So he took my file and burned it. And so for 11 years, more abuse continued after I reported it. So I just wanted to say, if it wasn't for Michael Kovacs, I wouldn't probably be here right now as I'm here today, because he kept on insisting, which encouraged me to keep going back to the diocese. I went back like 3 times. And then finally, by the time I, you know, made some headway. But it was actually the confirmation of what the other sisters went through that helped my case through. And so now going back to your question, it's really God. It's these moments of grace. And what I started to realize is that I needed to see it in the light of God's, you know, Jesus's passion. The abuse. I had to see it as when Jesus was being flagellated, I was being beaten. We shared the same commonality. And it's like, not saying that, you know, I'm right there with God. It's not like that. It's just like, you know, he can relate to you. You can relate to him type of thing. And it was like, nowadays I'm saying, because of all that has come out with Strange Pathways, and I had to really live my Lent with really confronting all the abuse of the order, you know, which has been really hard. And I would say, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And I had to say it over 1,000 times a day. Mm-hmm. And that's what kind of led me, you know, this gradual walk. And I failed a lot of times. I went into depression. I was suicidal 3 times. I mean, it was like, you know, I still go to counseling. I have now, by the diocese, counseling, a Catholic counselor on top of my regular counselor. So I'm in a work in progress. I think we all are, and we will be till the day we die, you know, whether you're abused or not, we're all in work in progress. So glory be to God, you know, like people like you, people like Maria Goretti Network, which I am a member of, and we have our own group where other religious priests and seminaries have experienced abuse that we can talk. It's been going great. And so from that stemmed helping, you know, trying to outreach in my own diocese, because like I said, there is nothing in my diocese. So I had to reach out to Maria Goretti Network. And I think at the same time I was reaching out to Hopeful Hearts Ministry, and it was online, and it was just like, I've never done anything like this, but it's just like, I need some form of help because I'm not getting anything. So it was actually staying with Hopeful Hearts Ministry, you know, and then like it was kind of not like on the back burner, but it was like on the side of me, and Maria Grady was on the other. And it was actually as well as the Guard of Honor Sacred Heart of Jesus is like how I told you how I when I was a sister, I try to look at things through the eyes of Jesus crucified. And so with a Guard of Honor, you're always at the foot of the cross, so you're with the suffering. So when I heard about, it was bad enough what had happened to me, but when I heard the abuse was still going on, it pushed me to say, I'm going back to the diocese, and then I'm going to report it to the DA, and then I'm going to go to the Metuchen, you know, call Metuchen Diocese and report it to their police department too. So I did do all of that because there was like this feeling like, okay, bad enough I was abused, but if more people are being abused, no, this has got to stop. You're right. This whole thing needs to be blown out of the waters, because if it's so deep in our church. I just read like 4% of priests alone of the population are abusers. And a long time ago, it used to be 1%. And I was just like, kind of like that throwing me back. But it says how many things that went unreported. So it pushed me to want to become more of the advocate, you know, the advocator. I just wanted to advocate for others. So I started abuse testimony on my Facebook page. And then I had other people come in from other orders, you know, that had suffered abuse. And there was one particular case, they were trying to get her blood sister out of there, because it was over the borders type of thing and it was abusive. And so lo and behold, that order is closed down now because it's been investigated and it was abusive. And men have come to me from mail orders, you know, all kinds of orders. And I think it's my spiritual director said, your healing will stop when you stop advocating. You know, and that's like stuck in my heart, you know, and it's just like, yeah, because God's love is on a continuum. God's mercy is on a continuum. This abuse may seem to be on a continuum, but God has the last, you know, he's won the war. He's, you know, we're fighting, but he's won the war. So all we do is has to be instruments of his mercy, you know, and it goes back to, you know, God's mercy, but also Christ crucified, you know, what did he do? And that's when he was being abused, he just said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. And this day you'll be with me in paradise, you know? And then even it's like, I thirst, but if you like really theologically break it down, he's thirsting for us, for souls. He's thirsting for us to come to him. So, and I'm glad you brought it up. I do now make these little ribbons. Okay. I don't know if you can see. I'll send you a picture.
Yeah, no, I like it.
Okay.
We love it.
Picture our charm.
I'm sorry?
Oh, I was reminding Tamara, we need to send you another charm because
we do.
Oh, yes, thank you. Yes. And so the ribbon represents our Blessed Lady's arms around us. Okay. And this is for the abused and non-abused. This is really what I got from my own experience. Sacred Heart of Jesus, or sometimes I put the Divine Mercy, whoever their preference when I make the ribbons, is that we're made in the image and likeness of God. And abuse tries to take that away from us, tries to take our identity away, you know, our identity in God. But we get that back. And the cross, the St. Benedict medal with it, is that you're protected, of course, special protection, you know, from the evil one. But also that we, our sufferings are in union with Christ's sufferings. And so it's to bring hope, you know, and because exactly what you are is Hopeful Hearts Ministry. So right. It is to bring hope to others. But also I had a chance to work in a jail with perpetrators in the sex offenders unit. And I got to see the other side of the coin. What goes on in an abuser's mind? What goes in their heart? What goes in their experience? Mm-hmm. And so it made me to even learn more to say, Father, forgive them. They do not know what they do. I don't excuse their abuse. Right. Never will. Cool. And it needs to be stopped at all costs. And there does has to be justice. But also, there's also mercy, too. You know? And so, and I think that helps me to live with my, I really have a harder time like forgiving myself, you know. I think we all have that though, like
I do.
Harder to forgive ourselves, and I'm that's work in progress. but then again, I have to say, Father, forgive me, for I do not know what I do. What I do. You know, a thousand times mm-hmm. a day.
Well, thank yeah. you, Patricia, for that. Michael, I'm going to come to you, but I do want to say just a real quick for the Maria Goretti Network. If you're interested, it's mgoretti.org, and you can find a group there. I used to lead one. We used to lead one in person here. And when I got divorced, I stopped. But it's something I've been wanting to talk to Tamara about. It is a support group for those that have been abused, and they have different types. So as Patricia was saying, those that are in her online group have all been, you know, in right, a religious order or something to that effect.
Or priests or seminarians, yes.
Right. So we have other, and it is men and women in one group together. And I think they're in many ways, and sometimes they break apart. There's been different roles, but that was what got me. I was in Maria Goretti Network first before I started Hopeful Hearts Ministry. It is a great support group. I do want to offer that. I was on their board even for a while. I just met with Father Gavin, who helped create it. I just had lunch with him the other day. So I highly, highly do recommend it. And the reason why I do love this particular support group is because not only are you around others and you get to talk about just kind of where you're at in that day of your journey of surviving and thriving, you do end with the journey of forgiveness. And it's a journey. Forgiveness is not a quick thing. And, you know, we've done a podcast on it, but we could probably do 5,000 more. Uh-huh. It's a journey. Okay. And so, but I love that or supposedly that's when I haven't been in it a few years, but they always end with an aspect of where are we at with forgiveness on ourselves or on the people, our perpetrators, et cetera. So again, that's mgoretti.org, mgoretti.org. Michael, real quick, what about you in doing this? You know, and we are commending you all over the place. You know, I think one of the things for me and for many of us, you know, we always wanted somebody to fight for us.
Uh-huh.
I'm going to cry. And just by you offering yourself and by doing that, like, just like Patricia said, I mean, you opened the door for so many of them to get together and to start talking and to start healing and then to start, it's like a ripple effect, you know, now they're helping others and now they're speaking out but what about you personally? You know, how are you feeling in your journey and continuing this plight to get that word out?
Well, let me go back just a sec. If anybody who goes through this, the worst part, like if anybody that goes through something, any trauma, any of all abuse, whatever, uh-huh. if you talk to anybody,
mm-hmm.
journal. Just write, get it out, get the narrative uh-huh. out of your head and into something. That's a therapeutic yeah. thing. That is a therapy. Get uh-huh. what's in your noggin and out. And you may not be able to, like, I couldn't find, there was, I went to, was it Snap? I think it was Snap in the beginning. And they were like, well, we can't help you. We have no idea about any of that. You know, no one could help you. There's no support group. Because this is bad. I'm like, so I'm alone. So it was very horrible. It was very horrible to be not believed and have no support group. Okay. The upside of not having a support group is there's so few of what happened here out there that you don't have a large group. Good. I don't want more people to go through this. So say is if those just write it out by hand, get a journal, get a notebook, type it on the whatever, get it out of your system. Healing wise, I mean, look, I'm in a unique position because my sister is still alive and she's still doing stuff. So basically, I have a scab that keeps getting opened. But in general, I don't look at it like what I look at it as like the only option. There really wasn't an option. It was just to kind of get it out there. And I was really trying to help my mom get this out there and get my mom better care, you know, in her home. So I didn't really see an option to not doing it. It was like, well, what's going to happen? All right, maybe some people think I'm crazy, whatever, and I'll lose my clients and whatever. Okay, fine. Well, I can't live with this. There's no reason for it. There's no logic for it. This makes no sense. But the only good you can spin from it is if you get out there and try to help others with it. And I don't know. I mean, this is my first time at this rodeo, but I'm saying if you can spin some good from it, then this by doing this, then do something, because there's nothing good about any of this. It's absolutely an abomination to God and man. But I'm like, well, if some people can be helped, yeah, sure, let's do this. And that's why I applaud anybody like you guys for listening, y'all for listening, my friend Scott for listening, and the Huffington Post. Anybody that will listen and give us an ear, give us a voice, I'm like, yeah, please do. There's so many people out there all over the world that have gone through this specific order. That it's like my last name is Kovacs, right? My sister's last name is, the only way I'm going to make this last name right is if I stand up for the truth.
Right.
What happened? I mean, it's horrible, but give me a better option, please. I'd love to have, you know, I'd love to know. But to me, this is easy. Mm-hmm. Constructing, you know, a narrative and pushing it aside doesn't if the truth sets you free. I mean, look, emotionally and psychologically, I have a limp. Okay, I mean, I got injured and I got a limp, but I can still walk. That's how I see it. And we know when you know, I don't know. I mean, but that's okay. I can still walk. I'd rather do that than be blind. You know what I mean? Than have. Then not see the truth and not just say it. I don't know. I mean, look, I'm just a guitar teacher. What do I know? I can show you how to play Green Day. Ladies, I'll show you to play I'll show you to play Iron Man by Black Sabbath
in
5 minutes. Smoke on the Water, 2 minutes.
You know what? You know what? I have this beautiful picture that someone gave me years ago, a mental picture of Jesus carrying a wounded lamb. And I always think about that when you just said emotionally, spiritually, you know, you've got a limp. I immediately thought of that picture of Jesus carrying the wounded lamb. And I think that's a good place for us to wrap up here today, because we all have been wounded. And thank you, Jesus, for carrying us. You know, that is how we move on in this life, is by the grace of God, and that Jesus carries us on. And he does it willingly. He does it because he loves us. He does it with joy. And it is our job to tell others that joy is possible and that we have a Savior that is willing to carry us. So, we are Hopeful Hearts Ministry, and you can find us at hopefulheartsministry.org. You can find us Hopeful Hearts Ministry on Facebook, on Instagram. We enjoyed having you here today, Michael and Patricia. Thank you much for your time, for your story. Your story matters, and we thank you for sharing it with us today. Grateful. Hope that you will join us all next time on Hopeful Hearts Podcast. Bye-bye.
Bye.
This is Tamara Lexo, the Executive Director of Hopeful Hearts Ministry. We want to thank you for listening to Hopeful Hearts Podcast. If you have any questions or would like to find out how you can support or receive help from Hopeful Hearts Ministry, look for us at hopefulheartsministry.org.